Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike. This week, we are pleased to have podcaster, author, and web video auteur. Isn't that an interesting way to put what you do?
Sure.
Dan Pashman in the house. Dan is the host and creator of the popular and frequently contrarian podcast, Sporkful.
It's not contrarian. What are you talking about, Ed?
The host of the cooking channel web video series, You're Eating It Wrong, and the author of Eat More Better, How to Make Everything More Delicious. Welcome to Special Sauce, Dan.
Thanks, Ed.
You actually dedicate the book to your parents, which led me to believe that they played a role in introducing you to thinking about deliciousness. So tell me about life at the Pashman table.
Well, food was definitely always a big focal point in my family's house. When we would go away somewhere, it was always like planning where we're going to eat, and then it was like filling the time between meals. And I certainly remember, you know, there were certain... So Tuesday nights and Thursday nights were the nights my mom worked late. And so those nights, we always had the same thing as we had a nanny who took care of us when she was working, and she made... Cottage cheese pancakes was Tuesday night, and hot dogs was Thursday night. And then Saturday night was French bread pizza night, frozen French bread pizza night. It was the other night that would be family dinner nights. Like Friday night, it's funny, my wife grew up in a more observantly Jewish house than mine, so she grew up Friday night with Shabbat dinner. For me, our family, Friday night was cocktail party, and we would eat mini hot dogs, and my parents would
But they were kosher.
Probably, yes. They were probably the Hebrew National mini
right.
ones. And my parents would have drinks Friday, end of the week, and my brother and I would have Shirley Temples. And I remember, like, back in the mid-'80s, we went to visit my aunt in Houston, and my mom fell in love with fajitas. This was before the sort of, like, before every chain had a sizzling fajita platter on its menu. And this was, like, a very exotic local food in 1985 to us in suburban New Jersey. And my mom got so obsessed with fajitas, and for like 3 years, it was like the great fajita phase in the Pashman family. There was a flank steak marinating in our refrigerator for three straight years.
It was all fajitas all the time.
There were a lot of fajitas over that period.
That's hilarious.
That really, and I still, to this day, I still love anything wrapped in a flour tortilla.
Although it's not a sandwich.
Correct.
All right. So who was the eater and who were the cooks in the family?
My dad loved to eat. My dad was not a big cook, although he'll be quick to tell you that he was a cook in the Army, and he did teach me, the first thing I ever learned to cook was scrambled eggs. He taught me how to make scrambled eggs. That was the first thing I ever remember cooking. My mom was more of a cook, and she would like get excited about things and go through phases where she would cook a lot of stuff. And my mom was more the one who was interested in restaurants, you know, like which restaurant is opening and which chef went to which place. And I remember like, it's funny, like even to this day, I just roll my eyes at that stuff. Like I just have such a hard time getting interested in it. And she'd be like trying to tell us the backstory of like this chef went to this restaurant.
It's the difference between, as you say, between foodiness and deliciousness.
That's right. Foodies.
But it sounds like your mother was a foodie.
She was a foodie, yeah. She was very into that. My dad, I think, more just loved to eat, but he does like a good meal too. So, yeah.
So when did your obsession with deliciousness first manifest itself?
I mean, I kind of have an obsessive personality. So I like to think about things a lot, and I'm just sort of a person with strong opinions. So over time, just like every little thing that I do, I'm always kind of like, I always feel like if the Sporkful doesn't pan out someday, I'll do a podcast about obsessing about other details of life. Like, don't get me started on socks, Ed. I have a lot to say about socks.
Wow. Are you going to write a book about socks?
I could. I probably could. So part of it was always my personality. I certainly always loved, you know, like I took piano lessons and I never liked to learn. Even before I could hardly even play the piano, I wanted to write my own songs. And that was sort of
so
always.
You're one of those.
I'm one of those guys.
People.
Yeah. Like I never wanted to follow a recipe. Like I could barely know how to cook and I still don't want to follow a recipe.
Got it. Got it. You went to Tufts. From reading your book, which has so many literary allusions and classical philosophical references, Were you like a classics major? I don't know. I just like, my mind was blown by the number of allusions.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I'm glad you appreciated them. There's a lot in there to unpack. I majored in political science, focusing more on political philosophy. So if there's one section of the book that you can most closely trace back to like what I majored in college, it's the Socratic dialogue about the ethics of snack mix. In which all the great philosophers come together over a bowl of snack mix to debate the ethics of cherry-picking specific ingredients out of a snack mix.
And that correlates directly to your interest and majoring in political philosophy.
Right.
Got it. Yeah. All right, makes sense.
And I kind of feel like there's almost nothing. You've been working in food for so long, you may feel the same way. Like, there's almost no issue about how human beings interact and come together that you can't dissect by talking about food.
That's totally right. Food is connected to everything, both serious and non-serious in the world.
Yeah.
And that's part of what I think keeps us all interested.
Totally.
But you, when you graduated from Tufts, you obviously weren't thinking you'd be incorporating food into your profession because you became a journalist.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, my first love, my real passion coming out of college was radio. That was what I wanted to get into. And I had also like written for the school newspaper and majored in political science. So I more went into news radio, talk radio. I kind of bounced around for a few years and then ended up at Air America Radio, which was the now defunct progressive talk radio network that had Rachel Maddow and Al Franken, Mark Maron, and
Danny Garofalo. Goldberg was involved.
He was one of the CEOs, right? One of the many CEOs who came through over the years. And that was sort of like my first real job in radio.
Oh, that may be where you said we first met with Vanessa Silverton when I was doing
Rachel Maddow's
show.
That's right. And didn't you also come on Mark Maron's show?
Yes.
We did a live show in the Upper West Side. I was Maron's producer. And you came on in that restaurant we did in the Upper West Side one Friday morning.
Yeah.
So really, radio is my passion.
You were covering politics. Is it still one of your obsessions?
I'm definitely interested in it. I mean, I will admit that I'm happy to not be quite so beholden to the 24-hour news cycle as I was when I was producing a daily news talk show. It's kind of nice to have a little distance from that and dip into it when something's happening that I want to learn more about. And I should say, like, some of the work I did was sort of more serious. Sometimes it was more like news, comedy, talk radio. And when I was working on Mark Maron's show, he certainly did musicians and arts and culture, too.
So was it working on Mark's show that really got you interested in comedy?
I was always kind of into comedy. I was, like, always a Comedy Central junkie, like, from when I was a little kid. When that channel first launched, I would just sit and watch Comedy Central for hours. I watched hours of Monty Python and those things. So, and I always loved good political satire.
Did you inhale The Onion when it came out?
I was very into The Onion, yes. Love The Onion.
So if you, as a fan of The Onion, you know, we all have our favorite headlines.
Mm.
So give us one that you found particularly hilarious.
I do love Drugs Win Drug War.
That's pretty great.
And it's got this photo of like some like middle-aged white politician in a suit, like shaking hands with like some stoner in a tie-dye shirt, like negotiating the surrender.
I like that. That's awesome.
Yeah, I think probably the one that comes to mind.
Okay, so how did you make the transition to food?
I mean, I kind of honestly fell into it. I had worked on a number of news talk radio shows, some of which were not very good, some of which I thought had some potential. But the shows kept getting canceled for a variety of different reasons. So I kept getting laid off. I lost something like 6 jobs in 8 years.
Wow. That's about the usual in old-fashioned radio, especially public radio.
Yeah.
Where it's a privilege to have them lay you off.
Right. It's tough. And I had the misfortune of kind of coming into the field at a time when there was the Great Recession, when there was all the tumult created by the rise of the internet and uncertainty over the future of legacy media. So there was a lot of anxiety and a lot of shows being tried and a lot of things being canceled. And around this time, friends of mine were starting podcasts. This is like 6 or 7 years ago. And they were like, you should start a podcast, you know. And I figured, at least if I have my own podcast, no one can cancel it but me.
It's the greatest thing in
the
world.
You know?
It is.
And it's like, look at what great stuff you're doing here. Like, you don't need anyone's permission to do it, which is so exciting. It's very creatively exciting.
Yeah.
So The Sporkful podcast was just the best idea that I had for a show that I could host. I always loved to eat. I was passionate about food, but I had never, other than waiting tables in college, I had never worked in food. But I thought I had this idea about a way to talk about food that would be different, and I decided to give it a shot.
That's great. That's the thing about podcasting and the internet in general is that creative impulses, there's, you know, the air is always pregnant with possibility when it comes to creative impulses. And it's why, as difficult as it is to make a living at it, it's still the most exciting time to be a creative person, you know, I think, anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like more good ideas out there than can be done.
Yeah, exactly. And when have we ever had that as a situation in media?
Yeah.
Right? We lived in a world of gatekeepers, and what podcasts signal is, bye, gatekeepers, see you around.
Right.
You know, that's kind of swell.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Sporkful. You mentioned it. How do you describe it? Like, what's your elevator pitch for Sporkful?
Well, it's evolved over time. I would say the original elevator pitch was, we obsess about the ridiculous food minutia in search of new and better ways to eat. That would be the original elevator pitch. The elevator pitch today, I would say, is more like, we obsess about food to learn more about people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of how the direction that's evolved in. So it's like, in the early days of the show, I would spend 20 minutes talking about ice cubes and the ideal surface area to volume ratio of ice cubes and what shape and melting rate you want in your ice cubes for the depending on the beverage and the weather and the time of year. And just like, the more ridiculous the detail, the better. Mm-hmm. And now that's still part of the show, but it's kind of like, by getting other people, it's less about my opinion about those things and more about, like, by getting other people to look at food through that lens, what can we learn about those people?
No, it's so funny that you say that, because as I told you, I spent a good part of this past weekend listening to probably 10 or 15 episodes.
Oh, wow. You'll be ready for a break now, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm ready for a little break. I'm good, though. But what was interesting is that it did evolve. So when I listened to an early Sporkful, it was much more about your take and trying to draw people into an artificial controversy just to have some fun.
Right.
And, you know, but when I listened to the one with Rosie Perez, I realized, wow, it's actually a great interview with Rosie Perez. And that's probably what you're talking about. You know, it's like, you allowed it to become as much about the person being interviewed as it was about your creation.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something when I started hosting The Sporkful, I had hardly ever hosted anything. So I'm sort of like mostly a self-taught host, certainly in my early years. And
I'm a firm believer that the best people in anything are self-taught.
Okay. Well, I'm going to put that on my business card. go on, yeah.
That's the way I've done everything in my career. It's like, I think I can do that.
Right. Totally.
You know, it's the Spanky and our gang.
Right.
Hey, let's put on a show.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You know, it's something that I struggle with because, like, you know, on one hand, I've learned so much being a WNYC and sort of like becoming more of a public radio fan over the years. So it's like, I've learned a lot from being more in that world, and in some ways it's made the show better. But I also get wary of, like,
of the conventions.
Right, the conventions and mimicking, you know, same thing with, like, food television, you know, or I'm sure you've seen it with food blogs. If you read all the food blogs, then Serious Eats isn't going to be a very interesting website, you know, and that's why it has its own voice and its own approach. So,
right.
You know, so that sort of evolution has been, I mean, I can't say that 6 years ago I said this is where it's going 6 years from now, but, you know, I sort of like, I'm always kind of looking ahead to, like, where's the next direction I want to go? What am I trying to get better at? What am I trying to learn?
Yeah. I think, you know, for me, it's, you just can't be afraid to evolve. You know, it's like, you can't be afraid of feeling uncomfortable. It's like, because discomfort is sort of a motivator for creative people, I think. Because you can't be afraid of it. If you're afraid of it, you're going to be standing in one place creatively for a long time. And it sounds like that Sporkful has evolved even in the relatively short period of time, although for podcasts, it's been around a long time.
Right. I'm like one of the old men of podcasting here.
Right, exactly. It's like someone once described me as the grandfather of food blogs. It's like, is that supposed to be a compliment?
You're like, I would have taken father.
I mean, what makes a great podcast to you?
I mean, this kind of gets, I mean, to some degree, it gets into taste. I mean, I think there's sort of, roughly speaking, there's two kinds of podcasts. There's the kind that try to immerse you, to bring you to a place or immerse you in a world. And these are the sort of more high production value public radio style shows.
Exactly. Highly produced.
Right. A lot of sound and scripted.
Let's face it, it all derives from This American Life.
Right. This American Life and everything that came after. And then the other kind is the sort of the conversational style of show, which is more, rather than transporting the listener to a place or immersing them in a world, it is meant to make listeners feel like they're hanging out with you, like they're part of your conversation. We're all sitting around the table together chatting.
And that's what we do. I mean, that's what you do, too. I think, you know, we always say, Marty Goldenson, our producer, who's been a long time in public radio, always talks about, actually, the goal is to have real conversation so that people are eavesdropping on a real conversation. And you'd be surprised at how that was not the norm in public radio and still isn't in many ways.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I'm like one of the few people in public radio who didn't start off as a 21-year-old intern, you know, like
unpaid, 5 years.
Right. And I started in talk radio, like I said, and so like in my sensibility, because I sort of was always interested in comedy and talk radio, and I grew up loving wacky morning zoo radio shows when I was a little kid, and those had formative impact on me, and sports talk radio when I was a teenager. So I love that feeling of feeling like it's a conversation, like it's unscripted. The show has gotten, the Sporkful has gotten more scripted and more planned out, but I still like try to really very much keep at the heart of it. I want it to feel like a real conversation.
You know, I alluded to the distinction you make between eaters and foodies in the tagline of Sporkful. So explain the difference to us.
Well, I think everyone's an eater. Everyone. Foodie, I think, I mean, is it the—and I don't necessarily— That's not necessarily a knock on foodies. I'm not saying you're a bad person if you want to call yourself a foodie, but—
You're not making a value judgment.
Right, that's right. But I think it suggests I think that— That term suggests to many people a certain degree of sort of condescension. Foodies are perceived as people who have a lot of focus on the hottest restaurants, the hottest chefs. They love to get into that sort of pissing contest of like, well, have you been to this place? I've been to this place. Well, was he cooking that night? What did you have? And then was it good enough for you or was it not good enough for you? And like, well, we went to, you know, and I just get... I mean, I work in the world of food now, and I still feel like an outsider in those conversations. I don't feel like they're very welcoming, and I feel like I can't find my place in that conversation. And so it was important to me when I started a food show that it would come across as the kind of show that people who don't fit into those kind of conversations would hear the Sporkful and be like, oh, okay, these are my people. I love to eat. These are my people. You know,
right.
That's what I wanted the reaction to be.
Sure. So... You are a person with very strong opinions, at least if you listen to the podcast or have read your book, and you back them up often with some scientific underpinnings,
right?
And sometimes I think you back them up with flights of fancy. And how do you? Would you say that's an apt description, and what are you trying to do?
I think you're right. I'm not a scientist, although I sometimes wear a lab coat. When I need real science, we'll have a scientist on or a person who's familiar with science on the shows. We've had Kenji Lopez on a number of times and love Kenji's work and love having him on the Sporkful. But if there's a little bit of science that I can cover, I'll do that. You're right that there are times that it's sort of more... I mean, to me, the dividing line of, like, do I want to debate this question or not is not is it real science or not? It's, is there some sort of kernel of objective truth to this debate? Or can we at least, like, argue that there is?
So give me an example.
Is a hot dog a sandwich? This is one of the most popular sporkful debates of all time. Is a hot dog a sandwich? And in general, what is the definition of a sandwich? And you know, like sometimes people will say to me, I'll get an email from someone that'll say, I like a lot of mayonnaise on my tuna salad sandwich, and my wife doesn't like a lot of mayonnaise. Tell us who's right.
Wow, you're an arbiter of some serious justice.
Yes, I know, really. I should be wearing a robe. And I'll say, you know, that's a matter of personal preference. I like the Latin saying, de gustibus non est disputandum. In matters of taste, there can be no dispute. And so I'm not going to tell you how much mayo there should be in your tuna salad. It depends on what you like. But the question of how to define a sandwich is something that I think you can argue there is an objective truth.
And you're actually interested not in just using that, trying to answer that question as something to riff off of, but I get the sense from listening to you now that these things, you think they matter in some way. Not change the world matter, but that people are clamoring for answers to them.
Well, they're definitely clamoring. The hot dog sandwich thing went crazy, you know, and I had a long-running feud with John Hodgman over that. We ended up doing a live show at the Bell House where we debated on stage on the media's Brooke Gladstone moderating the debate, which was a lot of fun. I mean, look, I do believe a hot dog's a sandwich. I also just sort of like to argue.
Yeah.
I come from a long line of lawyers, and so this sort of intellectual exercise of trying to build an argument and defend it is something that is fun, and it's something that Sporkful listeners really like and get into. I mean, if your question is, how much do I really truly hold these opinions? I guess it depends on the particular issue. I've never argued a point that I flat out did not agree with, but I will admit that there are times that I believe something, but also, like, I'm not going to lose sleep over it, but because it makes for a fun segment, I will kind of like take up the cause with more gusto.
Got it. Sure. So you have this theory that pies should be square.
Yes.
And, you know, it's not that I feel that strongly that pies should be round, except I like the look of round things more than I like the look of square things. But you have actually some very definite points you want to argue that would suggest that pi should be square.
That's right. Well, here's the first question, Ed. So you're looking at a classic slice of pie, a wedge from a round pie. Where on that slice do you believe you are going to get the best bite?
I tend to believe I'm going to get the best bite at the tip.
Really?
Huh?
I mean, because oftentimes I run into the tip, then you're going to get that bottom crust is like mush.
Not if it's a well-baked pie.
Right. We're talking about the 50th percentile of pie.
See, you're already, you know, I'm just assuming that I'm eating the platonic ideal of
a
pie.
Oh, okay. All right, okay. Well, we can go in that direction. So platonic ideal of pie, how would you describe the bottom crust at the very tip?
So the bottom crust, because a great pie is they're double-baked, right? So they first bake the bottom crust. So mm-hmm. You're not going to get that mushy bottom crust. So all the great pie bakers I know tend to double bake.
Okay.
So you don't have that problem. So the tip, right, you're getting the right ratio of crust to fruit, and actually you're getting the maximum fruit if it's a fruit pie, right, because there's none of the outer crust.
Right.
Right. So that's why I like that the tip of the triangle.
So you're a filling man.
Yeah. I mean, I love great crust, but I think a great pie is all about balance. Mm-hmm. And so to me, that tip gives you that perfect balance of crust and fruit.
Do you get any crisp typically with that bite?
You do.
Not
maybe
much, though,
maybe not
right?
As much as you would with an outer part of the
uh-huh.
crust. That's
uh-huh.
true. That's true.
Okay.
You just lack a certain crispiness. All right. We could talk about this for a while.
I mean, see, I would say my vote for the best bite, because I do like crust. I mean, to me, I think that the crust on the pie is what's more variable. Like, you don't need to be a great pie baker to make a good filling, maybe to make a great filling, but you can make a good filling. with a few basic ingredients. To make a really good crust, I feel like is more of a challenge. So if we're going to talk about the Platonic ideal of pie, the crust to me is really like, that's the treat.
That's true. That's and what separates the great pie bakers.
Right.
From
so the bite that I like is at the back end of that slice, because the any of the bottom crust is going to be a little bit moist or a lot moist
just
because
from
it has the weight of the fillings
right.
on it. So it's that vertical side crust that is not impacted as much by gravity is going to stay drier and crispier as a result.
Okay.
So when you get to that back end of the slice, you have a little bit of the bottom crust, the very end of the bottom crust. You have the vertical side crust, and you have the filling. You
All
have
right.
a three-sided bite.
Okay.
That, to me, is the best bite of a slice
right.
of pie.
I mean, whether I agree or not, it's certainly well articulated.
Thank you, thank you. And with a square pie, you get more of those bites.
Okay, all right. If the world took your advice and we only had square pies, could demographers and data junkies still use pie charts?
Well, there's a lot of resistance to this movement, Ed, because there's a big pie chart lobby out there. I'm not sure if you're familiar with them. But Big Pie Chart is opposed to this. Big Pie Tin, which is a separate but related group of lobbyists on K Street, they are also, they're really stonewalling me big time. So, you know, but I'm trying to get the bar graph people together on it, but they're like, they're just not as organized as Big Pie Chart.
This is the Pie Street lobby. Not K Street, it's
exactly.
the Pie Street lobby.
Right, right.
All right.
You know, and the people behind Pie Day, they don't know who to side with. They're staying nonpartisan.
Got it.
So
exactly.
It's very contentious.
Yes. Cheese on the bottom cheeseburger theory.
Mm, yes.
I mean, you've argued this with Kenji.
Yes.
And I have my own theory, which actually is not yours or his.
What's yours?
So I actually want cheese on both parts of the bun.
Okay. Do you like double cheese or you want it sliced half as
yeah,
thick?
Yeah, I want a slice of cheese on top and then a slice of cheese on the bottom. So to me, because then you're getting the benefits of cheese on the top of the burger and on the bottom of the burger and on the top of the bun and on the bottom of the bun. See, with your cheese only on the bottom, you're not getting any advantages of having a slice of cheese on the top.
What does cheese on the top add beyond more cheese?
It adds a nice cheesiness. And to me, it's not that you can have too much cheesiness, but I believe that if you're talking about a 3 ounce or a 4 ounce or even a 5 ounce burger, that two thin slices of whatever Kraft singles is not too much cheese.
We're crossing over into personal preference. To me, that would be too much cheese. I love the cheese, but the burger's the star.
Okay.
You know, and to me, a 4 ounce burger with two slices of cheese would be, it would probably taste delicious because melted cheese is delicious, but I don't feel like it would be my optimal burger experience. I like the cheese on the bottom because it accentuates it. It brings the cheese closer to your tongue. So when the cheese is on the top, if the burger's thick, you can often lose the cheese almost entirely. Bring it to the bottom to accentuate it a little more. Plus, it acts as a seal to keep the bottom bun from turning soggy. You get a little more cheese. If you're talking about a half pound burger, yeah. then maybe cheese on top and bottom I could be with
but
you.
A half
on
that. Pound burger is not a burger. It's a crime against humanity.
Wow. Well. Okay. Wow. That's fighting words.
So let's talk about your hot dog eating technique, which has also aroused a lot of controversy. Mm. You feel that since the most hot dog buns are throwaways, that you might as well just use a little bit of the bun, rip off the rest of the bun, and use the bun as a handle
mm-hmm.
to eat the hot dog.
That's right.
A lot of people would say that might be gross or weird, but I didn't think so. I've actually done it a lot with Gray's Papaya, even before I read your book,
okay,
when I was
all right.
trying to convince myself I was having a diet lunch.
So, it's the Atkins hot dog.
Exactly.
Right, right.
So, I mean, that's aroused a lot of controversy.
Yeah, I mean, and to be clear, I know you said it, but I want to make sure that folks understand. I think that most hot dog buns are pretty bad. If you have a great bun, that's moist and delicious and flavorful and complements the hot dog and is in the right ratio to the size of the hot dog.
But you don't think it should be toasted?
No.
Okay.
I don't want. I mean, if you're going to griddle it with butter,
then you're okay.
Then we can talk about that.
Okay.
But to just toast it, like fresh bread should never be toasted. Kenji and I agree on this. All right. Why do you want it fresh otherwise? But to me, so most hot dog buns from the supermarket at your typical backyard barbecue, white bread buns are just not very good. They're dry and they're flimsy. Why do you want them getting in the way of your hot dog? Like, the hot dog is the star. Enjoy the hot dog. So just take a little bit of the bun to grip the end of the hot dog, and you dip the hot dog into the condiment or condiments of your choice on a per-bite basis. Dip and eat. And then your teeth get right into that. Hopefully you have a natural casing hot dog, so you get that pop.
You need the snap.
The snap of the skin.
I understand.
And you're getting right into that snap. And
okay.
No mediocre bread getting in between you and your dog.
All right, that's good. So, oh my God. So, you could riff on this forever, which you do.
Yeah.
I'm just, as I said that, I was like, well, that's kind of what Dan does.
Yeah. Well, it's funny now. I don't know if this happens to you, but like now that I'm like known for talking about these things, but like I did honestly have opinions about these things and like talk about them with friends before I ever had a podcast. So now though, if I'm at a party and I'm like, oh man, look at this popcorn, the size, these kernels are perfect, you know, people are like, oh Dan, you're not in the air now, Dan, take it easy. And I'm like, no, I really want to talk about this.
That's awesome. All right. It's time for the special sauce 5-minute all you can say buffet.
Okay.
And this, I'm dying to know the answer, your answer, Dan. What's in your desert island fridge?
Flour tortillas. How many items do I get?
You get up to like a half dozen.
All right. You can tell I come from a long line of lawyers. This is my first question.
Yeah.
What constitutes an item? Flour tortillas, beer, cheese, carnitas or duck confit?
They're like first cousins.
Right, right. Let's go like a nice roast pork shoulder with crispy skin.
Ooh, now you're talking.
Okay. So I get the beer, the tortilla, the cheese, the pork, and then...
got two more.
Something spicy. I should probably just like sriracha.
Okay.
Just get like sriracha. That I can add that to anything. If I find some edible leaves on the island, I can season
the
sriracha.
And then you only have a sweet left.
Okay. I would say blueberry crumb pie with vanilla ice cream.
And you have this theory about the ice cream has to be out for X number of time, which I totally agree with,
yeah.
By the way. That's an overlooked part of serving dessert, is that people tend to just take the ice cream out of the freezer, scoop it, put it right in the pie, and deposit it at your place setting, and it's just wrong. It's
yeah.
just wrong on so many levels.
Yes, thank you, Ed. Ice cream should be served not super, super cold, because
right.
as it melts a little bit, it gets more flavor, it gets more aroma, it's more delicious.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. Who's at your last supper? No family allowed.
No family. You can come. I'll invite you.
See, I love guests who give that answer first. Francis Lamb told me if he was allowed 20 guests, I would be the 20th.
Well, that's well. All
that
right.
was the definition of a backhanded compliment.
But then, had you just previously told him he's only allowed 19?
No, I said 5. It was even worse.
Right. Let's see. Last Supper. Barack Obama.
All right.
Bruce Springsteen.
All right. Living or dead, by the way.
Right, right. That's true. Okay.
And you're an erudite dude, so you could go in all kinds of directions here.
Well, I suppose since I have the Socratic dialogue, we should have... Well, Socrates, I feel like he'd be a little bit dull.
Okay.
Let's have Nietzsche there.
Nietzsche. All right. So we got Nietzsche, Barack Obama, Springsteen.
Right. And we need some ladies there, too. Let's mix it up. Let's make sure we have a diverse crowd.
Right.
Eleanor Roosevelt.
You and Tom Colicchio wanted Eleanor Roosevelt.
Really? Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, I'm in pretty good company there then. Julia Child.
And all right. That would be an interesting. And if you did have an extra chair, I would come.
Okay. Good.
So what are you eating and who's cooking it?
I would want Julia Child to cook. I want Julia Child to cook. I want Bruce to hang out and play some music and tell some stories. Oh, maybe Willie Nelson should be there too.
All right. Oh,
that'd be pretty good.
You.
All right.
You can have an alternate.
We need some more diversity though. And then I would just want to like talk to President Obama and have a million questions for him about like, you know, just spill your guts, buddy. I want to hear everything. I want to know the truth about everything.
So if you could have a one-on-one lunch with anyone, living or dead, just have a couple hours to chew the fat, break bread, talk about food, life, politics, sports, whatever. It could be one of those people you mentioned, but it'd be more interesting if it wasn't.
So present company excluded. And, so we'll scratch off President Obama because he would probably be my first choice. And I guess saying Michelle Obama would be too obvious. I guess maybe Stephen Colbert.
Okay.
It's still hard for me to watch the new Colbert show, even though I think it's good, because I just love the old show so much. In fact, to bring it full circle, I'm 99% sure that at that live Marc Maron show, Air America taping that you were at on the Upper West Side, we also had Stephen Colbert.
Really?
On that same show. And it was 2 weeks before he was launching the Colbert Report.
Wow. And so some people who you had went on to great careers and others struggled.
And the two of us are sitting here.
All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing your special sauce with us, Dan Pashman. Check out Dan's podcast, Sporkful, and his web video series, You're Eating It Wrong. And do get yourself a copy of Eat More Better. Thanks for listening, Serious Eaters. Thank you, Dan.
Thanks, Ed.